Thank you, Mac, and I never thought you would go for selective engagement. Our last speaker is Admiral Mike Ratcliffe, and he brings some special things to this discussion, but also is perhaps a hopeful sign that interest in the questions of national security may be turning around, as Admiral Ratcliffe is Vice President for Programs at the ISI. I think it's an excellent place to start. And with his strong background as a former director of naval intelligence and an officer who had served in various intelligence assignments at both the fleet and the major commands, including the Pacific Command in Hawaii, I think is particularly well suited to increase our sensitivity to the kind of threats that are likely to emerge in the 21st century that we need to have a better understanding about, so that we can start to build a consensus among conservatives about how to deal with the national security problems of this century. Mike?
And no, you cannot leave, but Bill is going to have to depart now. I certainly, like everybody else, appreciate both your patience at these sessions. It's wonderful to be invited and to join with you during your discussions and to have the opportunity to talk with you briefly. And I am also very pleased and impressed by the way the Philadelphia Society conducts its meetings. We will finish at 3:30, and therefore nobody need be concerned that your time and the facilities or over the coffee is going to be called into question. My topic is present and future dangers. It's particularly an appropriate topic in the context of this discussion of conservatism and post-Cold War foreign policy, because I think conservatives especially are realistic and practical and appreciate the importance of always grounding discussions of defense and foreign policy in the threat, in the kinds of problems that we must face and be prepared to deal with. Now, I can do this one of two ways. On the one hand, I can kind of catalog all of those ways by which, as Bill said, we could be seriously dead in the next century, beginning with the kinds of chemical and other weapons of mass destruction that people like the North Koreans are developing, and the Taepodong missile, which they are developing in order to deliver it even at a distance great enough to get our attention in the United States, to talk about China's domestic submarine efforts, such as the Han-class submarine and the Zha-class submarine and the follow-on classes which they are developing, which will be increasingly difficult for us to locate and prosecute, and increasingly capable as platforms to carry out Chinese missions, the development of in-flight refueling capability for Chinese aircraft that will allow them to reach further and further out into the Pacific, down into the South China Sea and in other areas away from the Chinese homeland. I could talk with you about the kinds of things that were mentioned at the outset of this panel being developed in China or being developed in Russia that are then being shipped over to the rogue states, the pariah states like Libya, and enhancing their capability to cause mischief in the future. And that doesn't even begin to address some of the kinds of issues that have been discussed by my earlier colleagues on this panel, that is the terrorists, the drug lords, the cyber terrorists, which we haven't talked about at all. But at any rate, the catalog of present and future dangers that we could discuss is extensive, and I'm afraid it would just go far too long to cover it in the time we have. So what I will do instead is make three general observations, which I hope have some relevance to the specific question of present and future dangers, and tie that discussion back into the kind of foreign policy we ought to be trying to shape in order to be effective in the future. I'll give you a fourth point, however, as a kind of freebie before I start. I guess I couldn't talk to you as somebody who was the Navy's top spook, as the Director of Naval Intelligence is generally described, without telling you that we are not going to be effective in the next century unless we get seriously better at the spy game than we have been. The series of national embarrassments leading up to Mr. Thompson most recently that reveals our vulnerability to other people conducting espionage against us, and the equally embarrassing series of national reports revealing our ineffectiveness throughout the Cold War in the spy game just suggests how dangerous it will be for us to move into the future without an effective spy business, because that classically is the only way you're going to find out about the other person's intention. And the problem in an open society is, of course, we can barely get a secret before somebody wants it in the newspapers. We can barely get a human operation in place before somebody, in order to get a story or score a political point in Washington, puts that nest at risk and destroys our capability. We as a nation truly have to deal with that, and it's very encouraging to see in this new administration the seriousness with which they are addressing that. But as I say, that's a freebie that I just throw in for your edification, because I think it's so terribly important for us to think about it. But to turn to the question of present and future dangers, and the three observations I'd like to make, the first one is simply this: the world is dangerous, and it's going to get increasingly dangerous. Witness that catalog that I went through earlier. As Stan Evans might have characterized this, it is a major news flash in sunny, optimistic America that the world is unstable and dangerous. It may be difficult for conservatives to realize that there are an awful lot of Americans that don't want to believe that the world is as dangerous as it is. But if you go back to 1991, after the fall of the wall, after the collapse of communism, you'll recall that on the very day that Iraqi troops moved south into Iraq, the president went to Aspen, Colorado, and literally, as those troops were moving into Kuwait and making it clear to everybody that this was not going to be a kinder, gentler world in which we were going to have to make our way, he revealed the New World Order and described the kinder, gentler military, for example, that he thought would be appropriate in the New World Order. There is a tendency and a desire to always hope that these bad things are going to go away, that they were temporary, and that we won't have to put up with them in the future. The reality, as Mac has just described to you, is that it's important to pay probably that 3% of our gross domestic product as an insurance policy, because it will ensure that that dangerous world in which we for certain are going to have to live will be one in which we will be able to carry out our nation's business, and in which we will be able to prosper and do well. It's interesting, and this has also been discussed as well, that one of the things that will make the next century as dangerous as any that we've encountered is that the research and development investment that that countries need to make in order to develop the kinds of weapons that that are going to keep the pot boiling are being made by Russia and China today. Unfortunately, I think everybody here reading the nation, the press day by day, would recognize that our own skirts aren't even that clean. We're selling far too many dangerous weapons into the market on the world. The Russians and the Chinese are especially egregiously guilty of this, however, and that's why the Iraqis or the Cubans or the Libyans are going to, or the non-state bad boys out there, are going to continue to have access to world-class weaponry, not that they could ever develop develop it themselves, but because the market is going to continue to provide it to them. It's important for us to think about that as we look ahead, because there's no question at all that in the unstable world in which we are going to have to conduct our lives, that's going to be a continuing reality. You know, I was thinking as I was listening to some of the earlier remarks of one simple exercise that might be interesting if you want to understand just how unstable the world is. Take a map down sometime, get one of those National Geographic atlases, and go over it and try and find those boundaries between states that are actually legal and agreed to. I guess our boundaries with Mexico and Canada are in pretty good shape. But if you go beyond that, down to South America, to Asia, etc., you're going to find that the world is very unstable for the most fundamental reason that people haven't even yet agreed on their common boundaries in many cases. Another reason that the world is going to continue to be unstable and very dangerous is the extraordinary advances that are about to be made in the lethality of weapons, in the dangerousness of the weapons that are available. I will tell you, people on our side are looking to increases in the effectiveness of weapons, increases in the numbers of weapons that we can put on target of a 1,000-fold, even 10,000-fold magnitude in the coming several decades. If you can imagine that for every weapon that we can put on a target today, that in a couple of decades we might put 10,000 such weapons on a target, that may, you think, be good news for the United States, because we're clearly ahead of anybody else in developing these capabilities. Pray God we will maintain that advantage. But while we make that tremendous increase, all of the bad boys out there are also growing dramatically, and will grow dramatically in the lethality of their weapon systems too. They are not going to remain stagnant. They will continue to develop or to buy on the market weapon systems that will be dramatically more lethal than anything that they've had available to them heretofore. Everybody is aware equally of the emphasis on high technology in warfare. We talk about net-centric warfare, developing information technologies that will enhance and powerfully reinforce our military capability. That's going to be absolutely essential, absolutely key for our future effectiveness. But the bad news is that the net-centric capability we're going to develop as we become so tremendously dependent upon this advanced technology offers a vulnerability for the pariah states, the rogue states, those who wish us ill to exploit and take advantage of. And at the same time that it's giving them something they can take advantage of that we have to ensure we're in a position to defend against, it also gives them an amazingly powerful collection, connection, and dissemination capability. You can be a bit player in the world of the next couple of decades, and you will be able to buy militarily useful imagery on the commercial satellite market. You will be able to transmit that imagery around the world to the people that you may want to get it to, wherever they might happen to be, because of the backbone of the internet. You will even have cryptology. You'll even have security devices available to you that will make it very difficult for us to break into that and even know what's going on. So the net-centric capabilities that are going to be so crucial to our own future effectiveness are going to be increasingly available to the rogue states out there, to the terrorists out there, and to the others who will not make the kind of use of those capabilities that we would desire. But that should illustrate for you, in lieu of a more lengthy catalog, some of the kinds of reasons that if we look ahead for the next 50 years, that we should accept that the world is dangerous and it's going to get even more dangerous. The second observation I would make is that the world is ambiguous. Again, I think conservatives are well situated to understand both these things. We're not surprised that the world is unstable or dangerous. We're practical people who understand that. We're not surprised that that relationships are ambiguous. We have very few, if any, unambiguous friends in the world. Every friend is a competitor. Every potential enemy is also likely to be an important trade partner. Even every pariah state is probably someone we have to go to periodically to help us in the suppression of the drug trade or illegal arms trades or terrorist activity. Every relationship we have around the world is ambiguous, and we have to learn to work and be effective in that kind of situation. We have to take the world as it is, understand it as clearly as possible, and then be effective in it. And that leads me to the third observation. If every relationship we have is ambiguous, if every time we sit down with even some of our closest allies, we had better make sure that our wallet pocket is buttoned, because they're probably trying to pick it while they're doing business with it. If that's going to be true, it's extremely important for us to do what the Naval War College has been very effective at for 3/4 of a century, and that is to try and understand the world not simply from our point of view, but from the other point of view, because we cannot act wisely and effectively unless we can understand what the enemy or the bad guy or the potential adversary is thinking. That's something that the Naval War College did extremely well leading up to World War II, as they got inside the mind of the Japanese, and it's something they've continued to do very effectively. And I would invite you then to participate with me in about the next 5 minutes in a kind of exercise such as that. And since we've talked so much about China last night and during the day today, and because of my work with the Navy's China Working Group over 3 years before going out to the Pacific, where I was Director of Intelligence for our military forces there, I think it might be illuminating to think of China for just a couple of minutes. I might mention to you the context in which I served out in the Pacific, because I took over the Navy's China Working Group in March of 1996. You will understand immediately why we decided to establish a working group in March of 96. That was when the Chinese were lobbing missiles north and south of Taiwan, and we were introducing aircraft carrier battle groups into the area. And we were trying to understand the situation there as well as possible. And we realized that in the future, we would need to capitalize on this, get better at it, because it was going to be a steady line of business for us. So we set up a working group that for the next number of years focused on the China problem so that we would understand it well, because we realized that we had to understand what they were thinking even as we moved forces into the area, and we were not well positioned in 1996 to do that very effectively. Indeed, one of the things that we have done in the years since then is to start to open up lines of communication so you have more interaction and you could get to know the Chinese better, just so you can understand them and you can understand what they're thinking. Number one, just think of it in the most physical kind of sense. If you are standing in Shanghai or Canton or on Hainan Island, we may think that you're looking east across the broad Pacific and you're thinking of Hawaii and you're thinking of the California coastline. That's not what the Chinese are thinking. The Chinese typically are looking south. They're looking through the South China Sea, into the Straits of Malacca, Indochina, Indonesia, Australia, from where their iron ore and their oil and other energy resources come today and will increasingly come in the future. They're looking at the sea lines to their south that link them into the Indian Ocean and then on to the Persian Gulf, Arabian Gulf area. So the first thing to understand is kind of the strategic mindset of the Chinese, because as Americans, we often simply get it wrong at the beginning, and we don't realize where their strategic emphasis is as they look at their requirements and their needs. A second element that I suggest might be illuminating is to think from the point of view of the leadership in China of what they need to be doing. Despite some of the conversations we've had, I'll tell you that their priority on military capability is relatively low. because they know they have to put their emphasis on a huge population that continues despite their efforts to grow, and they've got to feed them, they've got to clothe them, they've got to educate them, they've got to employ them, they've got to house them, they've got to keep them happy enough that they won't overthrow this old husk of a communist regime that is now intellectually bankrupt and no longer commands any respect in terms of the intellectual element of the Communist Party. So they recognize that they need to keep their people clothed, employed, educated, as happy as possible. Indeed, we got a group of scholars together a couple of years ago, and we said, you know, let's start to draw up a list of all of the domestic problems that the Chinese have, so we can understand how we might approach the Chinese if we had that insight. After filling up three long charts with the domestic problems, the problem of people moving from the farm into the cities with no resources there, the huge problem of water that they have, the huge problem of people moving into the industrial areas along the coastal regions, and this tremendous imbalance between both the coast and the interior and the north and the south, this calcified regime that's investing heavily in information technology, fiber optic being laid throughout the country in order to move information around, and yet a regime that will cut its own throat if they really let the people use that information technology to move that information around effectively. When you go through that, you realize that this is not a strong regime. This is a regime with tremendous sources of instability built in. We, in one sense, don't want to do them a favor of being confrontational, where we make them the nationalist heroes standing up against the hegemonic United States. If we can avoid them becoming identified with Chinese nationalism, those men in Beijing, that continue to run the Communist Party, are really pretty far out on a limb, because they need to make so many things work for China to succeed in the future that they are really running a game that I don't think anybody going to Las Vegas would bet in their favor. Indeed, that in terms of the leadership of the Chinese, that's yet another element that I would suggest, if you look at the world from China's point of view, that's very, very important. Over a period of about 3 years, I had the opportunity to sit across the table as part of the American side with virtually every Chinese military leader who came out to talk with us. What was interesting is that, without exception, that was the first time they'd ever been out of China. These people are not very cosmopolitan. Their level of sophistication and understanding is pretty, pretty basic. If we understand this properly, we'll understand they are beginning to learn how they should behave in the community of nations. And we should be very, very clear to them as to what our expectations are and how they have to behave if they're going to be accepted into the community of nations. And yet, instead, what are we doing? We allow 50,000 Chinese graduate students to study at MIT, at Caltech, and every other graduate center of education in the United States that's developing militarily significant understanding. Figure out how many Americans are studying in similar centers in China. Not very many. We sit down with them in China, and I will tell you, they tell you straight up what they think of U.S. actions and U.S. policies. They come over here, and we break our backs being polite and pouring coffee for them for fear that we won't be seen as good hosts. We have to get over that. We have to understand that clear communication to the Chinese, so they understand our point of view, so they understand that we do not wish their regime well at all, but we're prepared to do business with them on the basis of reciprocity. And if they understand that, we may have a chance that, one, we can push them a little bit further in the direction of the demise of that regime in Beijing, but at the very least, we'll have a chance of developing a relationship that will not presume a bad outcome over the next couple of decades and saddle my daughter, your children or grandchildren with the burden of another Cold War or worse yet, a hot war in Asia. Nobody should seek that. Nobody, I'm sure, here seeks that. We have to work in ways that minimize that negative outcome and maximize the potential for a positive outcome that will benefit the United States. The conclusion that I reach is simply this. I think as conservatives, we are well positioned to understand and contribute to the debate about the foreign policy that we should pursue in the post-Cold War period because we are not misled by either that ideological straitjacket that led the Kennedy administration into so many missteps or by that innocence and optimism that can otherwise make a dangerous and unstable world seem as if it's a place that Pollyanna-like we can hope we'll just get a lot better. Thank you very much. We'll you take the microphone.